Welcome to another episode of the Gay Barchive Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and today our very special guest is Ted Binkley, a longtime patron of gay bars around the country and the former owner of Illusions and Crazy Rays, two of Atlanta's most iconic gay bars. Welcome, Ted.
Thank you.
You're quite welcome. I'm really excited to talk about some of the bars that you mentioned, because almost all of them are bars that I have never heard of before, which probably doesn't surprise you.
No.
But I did a little research and tried to track down some information. The first one that you mentioned was, I believe it was your first bar, first gay bar, called Arlene's in Nashville.
Right.
And the only information I could find about that bar is that it was located at the corner of 4th and Commerce, which is downtown near where Juanita's and the Jungle were later. And
then it opened away.
And it opened in the 40s. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your experience with Arlene's in Nashville?
Well, I was very, very young. 15, 16 years old. And I had never been to a bar before, a gay bar, or any bar. And a friend of mine asked me, said, go down with me. And I said, well, they're not going to let me in. And he said, yes, they will. So we went down there and I had a wonderful time. I saw I wasn't the only one. There was more people out there just like me. And it pleased me, and it pleased me to talk to people that understood what I was saying. So it was an exciting night.
I can imagine. I know I had my first gay bar experience quite a few years later in the 70s. And I felt the same way. Because back in those days, gay was not in the news. Gay was not in the movies. Gay was not characters in books. Gay didn't exist as far as the general public was concerned, unless there was a raid or, you know, some other contrary action going on with the community. They were causing trouble. But I don't think any of us knew that there was a whole community out there. And this particular experience, you said it was 1952.
Yeah.
So we're talking about almost 60 years ago, which is, I'm sorry, 70, almost 70 years.
Yeah.
We're talking about a time when, you know, gay bars were few and far between. And
that was the amazing thing to me about Arlene. And you, all the bars, you had to ring a bell to get in. And you could drink beer in one bar, but you couldn't get liquor. You'd have to go to a liquor bar. And at that time, we had Arlene's and the Jungle, and I went to both of them all the time and never had any problems getting in. And there was a couple of bars, Paratroopers and the 628 and a half club, that was not gay clubs, but welcomed you in and would hide me when the police came. So I never had a problem in Nashville dealing with being gay.
Now, many of the bars that I remember from the 70s and 80s, and well, especially in the 70s, were more hole-in-the-wall neighborhood type bars. There weren't as many, until the disco era came around, you didn't see as many big splashy bars. Is that what Arlene's was like? Was it just like a little neighborhood hole-in-the-wall with a handful of bar stools and
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's not surprising at all. We've come so far from there. Now, you were living in Nashville, obviously, at that time.
Yeah, I was born here.
Oh, okay. I did not know that. And then somehow, several years later, you ended up on the West Coast.
Yes.
How did you end up in Long Beach?
Well, chasing a person and caught them. They caught me or something, and we stayed together for quite a few years. And the Commodore, what I loved about the Commodore, it's the first time I'd ever seen men in dresses. And on Sunday, they did a thing. It was like Salvation Army Day. And they would serve like beans or some kind of soup in tin can. And I don't know if you're familiar with the song, the Salvation Army song.
I don't think so.
Okay, Google it and listen to it. It is the first song I've ever heard a person impersonate. And it's fabulous. It's a funny, funny song.
But, and that was at the Commodore? What kind of bar was the Commodore?
Oh, it was a great bar. It was bigger than what I'd seen in Nashville. But it had a stage. The stage was kind of maybe 4 feet off the ground and was long, narrow. But the Queens worked it.
Now, what time frame was the Commodore experience in?
I'm going to say, and it's hard to remember, but I'm going to say maybe 55.
Oh, so it was still in the 50s when you went to the Commodore.
Uh-huh.
A few years after, you just, I guess, barely reached adulthood and decided that it was time to escape Nashville and go chase a man across country.
Yep.
Now, you also mentioned another bar in Long Beach called the Holler Inn.
Yes.
What kind of bar was that?
It was a piano bar. And you'd go in and they had a pianist from open to close. And it was a wonderful bar. It was a true neighborhood bar.
And they were full liquor. They served alcohol, beer, everything.
No, just liquor. You couldn't sell both in the same building.
Wow, that seems so weird.
Uh-huh.
Did they have drag shows there as well, or was that just a...
No, just a piano bar and a lot of gay customers.
And no dancing.
No dancing.
Which was also common back then. I don't know if it was true in Long Beach, but a lot of places... you had to apply for a dance hall license to be able to have dancing in a bar.
Yep.
Now, one of the most famous bars from Long Beach that I discovered, and I've had hundreds of people mention it to me online, was Ripples. Was that around while you were there, or did that come later?
It must have come later.
Okay, because that apparently was a longstanding, I think 40-year or something, bar in Long Beach as well. Now, the one that really surprised me, besides the fact that your first bar experience in a gay bar was almost 70 years ago in Nashville, which is not exactly what we would consider the epicenter of gay nightlife even today. I mean, I know there are gay bars there. I live there myself. But the other one that you mentioned was in Montgomery, Alabama, called Zippers.
Yeah, that was the club that I own, and it was a great club. And what I had shows, and it had five different rooms to the bar, and the front lounge, the main lounge, the queens that did my show, especially at night on the last show, they were crazy. It was all comedy. We did naked country love songs, and we would take whipped cream on our last song and put it in each other's face because we found out that it removes your makeup. And but they were crazy. They would roll on the floor. It was nuts. And that I loved that bar because of that. It was the people, the way they behaved. Like they really had a good time. And then in the downstairs bar, we did a cameo thing where a queen would just sit on a pedestal and sing the songs, and then we would tape in their areas where they could talk to the customers.
I know a lot of the bars back in that time frame tended to be oriented either toward men or towards women. Was that the case with the bars that we've talked about so far, with Arlene's, Holler Inn, Commodore? Were they mostly men's bars, or were they?
Yep.
They were.
Yep. Yep.
When you opened Zippers in Montgomery, what time frame was that?
Let me think. I'm going to say 90.
1990.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And that was, I'm guessing by that time, more of a mixed bar, even though it was predominantly male, maybe. There would be some women that would come in for the shows and the other entertainment that was going on there, or was it still strictly a male bar?
Yeah. No, everybody got along well. And we had both female and male. It's about 50-50.
Yeah, I've seen that happen a lot, especially in the smaller towns or smaller cities, where they don't have a dozen gay bars to choose from. And so you tend to get a little bit more, you know, cross mix of clientele in there. Now, Zippers, there have been, I don't know, half a dozen or more Zippers around the country. And quite a few of them were go-go bars, which I guess makes sense when you think about the name. What inspired you to name your bar Zippers in Montgomery?
Well, the way it came about, actually, the people that had it, it was a gay bar, and they were going to be kicked out. And I bought their lease from the owner of the building and kicked them out and took over. And it was like, Zippers seemed like, I said, oh, zip it up. And that just said, Zippers. And that was how it came about. Just saying something, you know, how it sticks.
Now there's obviously a big gap between the late 50s and early 60s with the bars in Nashville and Long Beach, and the 1990-ish time frame of Zippers. And I happen to know from personal experience that you spent a lot of that time in what at that time was considered the gay capital of the South, Atlanta, Georgia.
Right.
And you had quite a few bar experiences in Atlanta as well. I think I remember from a previous conversation, you mentioned that Gallus was a favorite restaurant and bar back in the day.
Yeah.
Now, I remember Gallus. I remember going there frequently. And it was a very unusual mix. The upstairs was like a white linen, fine dining experience with waiters and excellent food. For some reason, I remember Chicken Elizabeth. Is that right?
Uh-huh.
And they had great brunches. And it was you almost felt like you need to be a little bit dressed up to be in there. It was a nice, elegant atmosphere. And it was in an old funeral home. Is that correct? Is that what that building was?
Well, that's what I've always heard, but I was told that that's not really true.
So it was just a big old building sitting on the corner of 6th and Cypress in Atlanta, with this fabulous restaurant upstairs.
Yep.
And then if you happen to wander down into the basement bar, it was like night and day. It was a completely different experience downstairs.
Yeah. Amber Richards and I went there a lot together. And when we would go down the steps, she would give me your American Express card. And I said, okay. And give it to her. And she'd wet it and stick it on my forehead. She said, forehead. And she'd say, let's go on in now. We're ready.
And the Gallus downstairs was known for its, I hesitate to call them go-go boys. They were more strippers or I don't think they quite got up to the level of what we now call go-go boys, but they were just guys that were dancing in their barest minimums. And it was, from what I understand too, a popular place for men to, how can we say this? Find dates.
Yep.
At a small expense.
That was a nice way of putting it.
But the whole neighborhood, actually, that whole corner was known for hustlers to begin with. That 6th and Cypress area was, there were outdoor hustlers as well. So right. It was of course, that has changed dramatically. We no longer have a Gallus or anything like it over in that vicinity. And you were not an owner there. You were just an enthusiastic patron, correct?
One of their best customers.
I'm sure you were. And then you decided you wanted to be in the bar business yourself.
No, that happened by accident. The bar was already in existence, and I was asked to join it, and I did.
Which bar was this?
Crazy Rays.
So we all know about Crazy Rays. The building is still there, and the space is still a gay bar. Today, it is called Mix, M-I-X-X, and it's changed quite a bit on the inside, and I think the clientele has changed quite a bit. But back in the day of Crazy Rays, they were also known for good food and Sunday brunches and great entertainment. What do you remember most about being involved with Crazy Rays?
Well, the customers were local people primarily. And it's people that you saw almost every day. And we had a wonderful staff. And the food was good. The cooks were good. It was just a good mix. We had a patio that people enjoyed. And it was just a nice neighborhood bar.
Yeah, I remember it fondly. And if I'm not mistaken, at that time, in that plaza, it was the only gay bar at that time?
No. What was the one on the end? Marsh owned it. I can't think of the name of it. I can't remember.
I remember across from Crazy Rays was the San Jose Mexican restaurant.
Yes.
Which was about the gayest Mexican restaurant on the planet. and Amber Richards actually worked there as a waitress for quite a while.
Uh-huh.
It was quite a popular attraction there. People, I think, would just go there just to be able to rub elbows with her and talk to her for a minute while she was serving them some burritos or enchiladas or whatever they were going to eat. But that plaza has blossomed into a gay mecca. I don't even know how many gay bars are in there now. I think there's Oscars, Felix's, Mix, Midtown Moon, which used to be Burkhart's.
Yeah, that's the one I was trying to think of.
Was Burkhart's already there when Crazy Rays opened, or was it something?
No, it came later.
Yeah, I thought so. I thought, was it Paul Hargash was
yes.
The original manager and maybe an owner?
Yeah.
And they moved there after Blake's was evicted from their Peachtree Street location. And Mark Ramey went over and opened Blake's on the park. And Paul Hargash went and opened Burkhart's in the plaza. Both around the same time. So that would have been probably what, the late 80s?
Yeah, I would say that.
And Burkhart's continued to operate until just a few years ago when Palmer and his wife made some unfortunate comments online and basically got boycotted by quite a number of the drag entertainers and the patrons and were forced to sell. And so it's now called Midtown Moon, which I believe is Midtown Moon is owned by the guys that own Oscars, correct? Right across the plaza. Yeah,
I don't know.
Now, another claim to fame that you had in your Atlanta days was a bar that many, many people talk about on a regular basis. I did a poll on my Gay Barcast Facebook group last week asking people to vote for their three top gay bars from Atlanta's past. And the poll reached over 5,000 people. As you might have imagined, the number one spot by a landslide was Backstreet.
Yeah.
But in the top 10 was Illusions.
Yeah.
And you are permanently connected to almost everybody's image of Illusions. How did the whole Illusions project come about?
Sweet Gum had closed. And we had a love for Charlie, Satan, primarily, at that time. So decided to open something that they could work in. And we decided that we would have a show based on production work rather than single acts. And it just came about and just really worked.
It really did. It's one of the most memorable bars. I moved to Atlanta in 1983. And I remember going there and feeling special, just the way the first gay bar that I walked into made me feel warm and fuzzy about knowing that we had a community. Illusions had a little bit different effect, because when you walked into Illusions, it was almost like you're walking into a Broadway theater or something. It was very nice environment. You felt like you were worthy of an upscale bar that had quality shows, that had, a very clean environment. And I don't remember ever seeing any kind of major altercations or fights or anything there. It's like everybody knew when they walked in the door to Illusions that they were expected to act like adults, and they did.
They did. They really did.
It was known as the Showplace of the South. And I've spoken to a couple of people about it in some of my interviews. Bob Taylor was one of them. And they all mentioned the same thing, that they can barely remember a single individual performance by a drag queen. That almost everything they think of when they think of Illusions was big productions. One, two, three drag queens sharing a song with half a dozen backup dancers, both male and female. It was a big effort to put on quality entertainment. It wasn't one drag queen on a bar stool lip syncing to a song. It was, Broadway style entertainment.
Yep.
And by this time, you were actually performing occasionally as well, correct?
Right.
The one and only Dora DeVille.
Yeah.
Now today, a lot of the drag queens, have families or houses that they belong to. They're connected by, a last name and a sort of family camaraderie. Was the DeVille name a family name? I mean, I know there was a Morticia DeVille and there was Dora DeVille. Were you partnered in any way, or was that just a coincidence that you both chose the DeVille name?
No, of course, Satan was first. And I took the bill because I was gaining weight. And a friend of mine said, you know what? I'm going to start calling you Doraville if you don't quit gaining weight. And I said, well, that's a good last name. So I took the bill. And Morticia, of course, was my daughter. I was the one that, you know, put her in drag, helped her paint for a long time.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
So I guess that would make me your grandson. Because the only time in my life that I have ever done drag, a friend of mine, a coworker, had just purchased a house in Grant Park that was in need of restoration. And he decided to have a big Halloween party there in the late 80s. I believe it was the late 80s. And he required that you come in costume. And I had no idea what I was going to do for a costume. So I asked my friend Dwayne if he had any suggestions. And at the time, he happened to be Morticia's roommate at Peachtree North.
Uh-huh.
And he said, we'll take care of it. When you come home from work on Friday, just come on up to our unit and we'll have you ready. And so Morticia put me in drag for the one and only time that I actually did drag. And I will never forget that.
Yeah. I loved her. She was quite a gal.
Indeed, she was. So Illusions lasted for how long in Atlanta?
3 years.
And yet it's made an indelible mark that people still talk about to this day. And if you look at the list, there were over 50 bars nominated in my poll for somebody's favorite bar or other. And you look at the names that are on there. It's really impressive that Illusions made it up to the top 10. And Crazy Rays, I think, came in at number 12. So it was up there, too. But it's just so interesting to see which bars people are remembering and which ones they have spoken fondly about. Now, those were those your only two bars that you owned in Atlanta?
Yeah.
Crazy Rays and Illusions?
Yeah.
And then eventually you moved to Montgomery, Alabama, and decided you still didn't have the bar business out of your blood.
Yeah.
And how long was Zippers around?
Well, Zippers, see, first of all, I moved down there for we opened Studio F. And that was an old Morrison's cafeteria. We had like 75,000 square feet in the club.
Wow.
And I decided let's bring drag down here. Let's bring Atlanta-style shows. And so we did that. But the problem was there wasn't enough people lived in Montgomery that could support it and support the cost. The weekends were just barnstormer. But starting on Sunday through Thursday, you did nothing. And it was just way too big. And so after we only had that open for a year. And then I went over with Zippers.
75,000 square feet. That must have been one of the largest gay bars in the country at that time.
It was huge. It was part of an old Morrison's building that was in a big building that Morrison's was. I told you 75,000. I didn't mean that. It was 10,000 square feet. I said, that didn't sound right.
That's still big, though.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure Backstreet was that big.
It was, we had a huge room that was a piano bar, and then we had the main room. The dance floor was all marble because of it being Morrison. Then we had a penny bar where we had all the games, and we had an infinity hall that went from the penny bar to the piano bar, that when you walk over, you couldn't see the end. And which was quite interesting, and had birds in cages in the piano bar, all kinds of birds.
Sounds very nice. Now, in Atlanta, when you opened Illusions, you know, a lot of people, I guess, don't know what the scene was like in Atlanta back then. Atlanta was pretty well known for its show bars. I mean, Sweet Gumhead, of course, was the cream of the crop when it was open, and everybody talked about that. But after Sweet Gumhead closed, Atlanta had more show bars open than anybody I think I've ever heard of.
Uh-huh. There
were show bars everywhere. Of course, we had Illusions, we had Lipsticks, sometime we had Levitas. Hollywood Hots had a show bar, I believe.
Yeah.
Showcase Cabaret. There were just, it seemed like everybody was opening show bars in Atlanta. And then eventually, of course, when all those independent show bars kind of closed down and Backstreet brought Charlie Brown's Cabaret in, that became, and it was certainly big enough to be its own bar. Charlie Brown's Cabaret was bigger than probably most bars in the country, just that one section of Backstreet. But it's odd that you mentioned that some of the same performers kind of went from one to another. Because I know Charlie performed at Sweet Gumhead, made it through Illusion. She performed at one of the bars on Cheshire Bridge. I don't know if it was Hollywood Hots or what, but also to Illusions, and of course, ultimately Charlie Brown's Cabaret. But it was quite a scene there.
Uh-huh.
When you were doing drag, did you ever compete for any of the competitions, or were you strictly a stage performer that did it as kind of a casual side thing that you enjoyed doing?
I did it for the dresses. I did it because I like beautiful clothes. But I'll be honest, I entered the answer, had a pageant called Miss Chubby America. It was a precursor to At Large. And I entered that and won that. And Sadie DeVille and Charlie Brown were my backup dancers.
So you have now been out of the gay bar business for how long? 20 plus years?
Well, see, 95.
Okay. So we're talking about 27 years.
Uh-huh.
Do you still go to gay bars at all? Do you go out and see what?
No.
So you haven't.
I'm 85, and I just stay around the house most of the time.
Well, you're looking a lot better than a lot of the people I know in their 60s.
Well, and I still work.
I guess you do.
I have a job that I work 20 hours a week. It just gets me out of the house, gives me some organization to my life.
Keeps your mind sharp.
Pardon?
Keeps your mind sharp.
Yep. And seeing I'm the only person in my family, my immediate family, that has not had or have Alzheimer's. And my doctor thinks it's the reason that I don't is because I work.
That and drag. I think drag had something to do with it. It kept your mind fresh. You had to change back and forth. I'm this character, I'm that character.
Yeah.
So during the course of this project, I've spoken to all kinds of people, people who own bars, people who manage bars, entertainers, celebrities, patrons. And one question that I'm always curious to find out is why they think recording and remembering the history of our gay bars and our gay community is important.
Because it's us. Nobody else has done it. And, you know, if we don't understand, when I was in Atlanta, I'm not bragging, I'm just telling you, I was the president of the business and of the Atlanta Business and Professional Guild. I was on the advisory council for the police. I was on the board of directors at Midtown Business Association. So I was always constantly working. And it's just like I was the president of the bar task force. And one day the guy delivering Miller to the gala started making fun of the customers. And so I called the task force together, and we all the gay bars set our Miller beer on the sidewalk and told them to come get it. And it's strength. It's what do you know? If you don't have information, you don't have a chance.
I agree. And part of the reason that I started doing this was, you know, I noticed that so much of gay history that you can find online or in libraries or wherever focuses on the riots and the turmoil and the issues with police or whatever. And so little of it talks about the individual bars that played such an important role in how we organized ourselves, how we got to make friends, to share ideas, to kind of blossom into our gay personalities that we would not have otherwise been able to do. And I know you've always been a part of that. Another person who I know you know well from Atlanta, Dina Collins, was incredible. I think the tagline for her bar, Dina's, One More Time, the tagline was a bar with a sense of community. And she really lived that philosophy. And so many bar owners did. You know, you were there. You were in the bar. If we went to the bar, we knew you. You were a friend, a family member. And we felt connected as a community. Things have changed a lot.
Yeah.
You know, now a lot of it seems more corporate. Even the bars that are owned by local bar owners, a lot of times they're distant. They don't show up. They sit in their office. They don't interact with their staff or their guests or whatever. And it was a totally different environment back then. Yeah. I mean, I think every Pride March, every fundraiser, every rally that ever happened had its roots in a gay bar back in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, I think a lot of the younger people don't know that or recognize it. They think bars are places to go get drunk and, you know, pick somebody up. And,
well, you know, it's just like, if I had not been involved in Illusions, I became the Dowager Empress of the Royal Court. And the court, we took 1 month, and every night we went all over the Southeast doing shows, raising money. And in 30 days, we raised $28,000 for Aid Atlanta. And, you know, the queens, and if they can't work, if there's not a bar to work in, they can't raise money. And yet we have been at times the only people raising money.
Oh, I know. I was speaking with someone from the what used to be called the National Gay Task Force. They are now, I believe, the National LGBTQ Plus Task Force. But at the time, they were called the National Gay Task Force. And I also have spoken to the founder and president of Equality Florida, and they both told me the same thing, that had it not been for the bar community and for the drag queens, those organizations would not exist, because that's where the money was raised. They couldn't go out and ask Coca-Cola to give them 10 grand because it wasn't going to happen. It was all done on the backs of the bars and the drag queens.
Yeah. And, you know, and I can remember time in the old days, and believe me, I'm talking about the old days, when the police would come in, the vice squad would come into a bar, and they'd sit next to you, and they would entice you subtly so that, and when you make a move, the handcuffs go on you, and you go to jail. I've known people that's happened to. I've watched it. And you never know anymore in our living day, is it going to go back to being like that? I have fear, because it seems like they're playing their time away. They're not thinking.
Yeah, and I think we learned during the last 4-year administration that our gay rights are not etched in stone. And maybe that has scared a few people into realizing that we could backpedal quickly if we don't stay vigilant.
Yep. And I worry about it. You know, for me, my 85, I'm satisfied. I've done everything in my life I wanted to do. I've lived in India. And, oh, and by the way, there's a gay bar in India called 10 Downing Street that is fabulous. Fabulous.
I love the name.
Well, see, it's the British
Prime Minister.
Yeah, influence, yeah.
I just think it's funny. It's like opening a gay bar called, you know, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
But I just think, step back, look at what we've accomplished, and it's been a lot. And if they look at it, the bars have been in the forefront of all of it.
I agree. And that's why I'm so glad that I've been able to do this project and talk to people about those memories, so that people who weren't there to experience them can hear not just from me, but from 20, 30, 40 other people who lived through these experiences in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, in the bar scene, saying the same thing. And maybe it will drive the point home and people will realize that, you know, we went through a lot, but we survived it. And I think we're all stronger for the experience. And maybe it'll give them a new perspective, instead of saying, well, you know, I only want to go to a bar where there's no old people and no fat people and no people of color or whatever, and just be a community like we were back then.
Yeah, absolutely right.
Now, I have one question for you that we hadn't really discussed or talked about at all, but I've asked several people who lived through this era, not living in New York City, being in other parts of the country. Did you feel like there was a big impact either mentally or socially after the Stonewall riots in 1969? Did that impact you at all? Did you have any awareness at the time? Or was it just, oh, there's something else going on, you know, somebody else harassing us?
You know, and I hate to say this, I knew it was happening. And of course, I was appalled by it. I hated it. But, you know, it didn't influence anything around me.
Right. I've heard that from a lot of people. You know, the younger people seem to think Stonewall was, you know, when it happened, was such a big deal that it was, you know, on the news 24/7, and the whole world changed overnight. Like, you know, somebody had dropped an atomic bomb on the city. And so many of the people I've spoken to who were not right there, who did not live in, you know, Greenwich Village, it was almost like the same old story, because every city, I know you were in California in the 50s. There were riots and uprisings in Los Angeles and in San Francisco in the 50s.
Yep.
You had the two black cats, the one in Los Angeles and the one in San Francisco. And you had Cooper's Donuts in LA. I think it's just that by the time 1969 rolled around, Stonewall did get a little bit more press, and people kind of took that and said, this is, you know, the cause of our fight for our rights. We, you know, they use it as an excuse, whereas people who lived almost anywhere else in the country had their own personal experiences, like you said, with police raids and arrests and things like that. So, but I just wanted to hear it from you, because I knew that, you know, you would have a memory of it and be able to say something about it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's been great talking about all these bars, and I'm going to have to do a lot of research now, because I am going to be hell bent on finding some kind of logos or photographs or something for Arlene's, for the Holler Inn, for the Commodore, for Zippers. Does Zippers have a logo?
It did, but I don't even have a copy of it. All it was Zippers, in the bottom of the Z was a zipper.
Oh, okay. The bottom of the first Z. With an S.
Yeah.
So there's also one of the Zippers bars spells it with a Z at the end.
That's above me.
But I know you couldn't do that, because you have to spell it correctly. You couldn't look at that logo if it was misspelled.
Yeah.
Well, I hope you're enjoying your semi-retirement in Nashville. I'm actually planning on going to Atlanta Pride this year for the first time in I don't know how many years, partially because of this project, and partially because I haven't been to Atlanta in 7 years, so I think it's time.
The one thing I'll leave with you in my thinking, we have to somehow get people to support gay bars. I know that it's most places, especially like Atlanta, where you can go anywhere, and I understand that. But they've got to support the gay bars, because when it's all said and done, that's the community.
Absolutely. Gay bars and gay businesses.
Yeah.
You know, you can't buy every rainbow t-shirt for Pride on Amazon, because you got a local business. You know, I'm sure there's one in Nashville that sells a lot of LGBT products.
I mean, yeah.
Amazingly, Atlanta has had Brushstrokes for over 30 years.
I thought, because it was there when I was there.
I know. I can't believe they've been there over 30 years. I remember when they opened up that little store off the arcade on Virginia Highlands, Highland Avenue. And I thought, this is a strange place for a gay store. But then they moved across from Burkhart's, and I think they've taken up about half of the plaza across from Burkhart's. They've got like three storefronts in a row, or four. So somebody's supporting them there, which is a good thing. And Mark Jackson is still there.
What is?
Mark Jackson.
Oh, really?
One of the two guys that opened it? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, he was there 7 years ago when I was there. I assume he's still there.
Where do you live now?
Tampa, Florida.
Tampa. Okay.
Yeah, I wanted to be somewhere sunny and warm.
Yeah.
I don't ever
know. I wish it wasn't quite as warm as it is.
Well, it doesn't get any warmer here than Nashville. People don't realize that. It has never, in the history of weather records. It has never gotten over 100 degrees in Tampa.
Oh, it has here.
I know. I've lived there. And and it's humid, too.
Yep.
But
that's what kills you.
But it's a great city. And maybe you should go out and have a beverage at a local gay bar in Nashville sometime.
Well, and I've been putting it off. I just, you know, okay. I just don't do nothing, you know.
COVID kind of threw a wrench in the works too, didn't it?
Yeah. And I'm, you know, I'm just really content. I have reached the time in my life. I am so content because I've done everything I wanted to ever do. And now I can just sit back and I can think about them.
You can
think about the things.
And you look happy and you look healthy. So, you know, that's great. I mean, we're glad that you're enjoying your semi-retirement. I don't know. Will you ever retire?
I doubt it. I tried it for about 3 years and I think my daughter got tired of me coming to Phoenix to see her. So I said, well, I'm just going to go back to work.
I'm going to get a job again.
Yeah.
Well, we wish you all the best. And I know many, many people that I've spoken to from Atlanta remember you fondly. You just made an indelible mark, even with a few bars that, you know, you were involved with for a number of years in Atlanta. It's over 30 years later, and you're still in everybody's hearts and memories. So
well, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us about this. And
Sure.
And that concludes another segment of the Gabe Archives podcast. You can find more podcasts at GabeArchives.com/podcast. We also have more information about this podcast and links to the other podcasts we have completed. We hope you enjoy your trip down memory lane.